I'm Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1 The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, you will hear stories from Katie Weaver and Anna Mateo. Later, Dan will present this week's education report. Finally, Kelly Jean Kelly tells us about the presidency of William McKinley. But first, here is Katie Weaver.
Law enforcement agents in the United States searched and seized evidence Monday at the Florida home of former President Donald Trump. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, or FBI, is investigating possible illegal treatment of secret U.S. information, recognized by the government as classified. Trump himself was the first to report the FBI action at Mar-a-Lago, as the home is called. It is in the city of Palm Beach. Trump was not home at the time. The former president said in a statement, "After working and cooperating with the relevant government agencies, this unannounced raid on my home was not necessary or appropriate." He said the search involved a large group of FBI agents, adding, "They even broke into my safe." Trump did not say what the agents were looking for at his Florida home. His son, Eric Trump, told Fox News that the search concerned documents that Trump had taken from the White House. The U.S. Justice Department and the FBI did not comment about the reported search. But the Justice Department has been investigating the possible abuse of classified information during and after Trump's departure from presidential office. U.S. law requires that all official presidential records, including letters, notes, emails, and all other written communications, are saved and sent to the National Archives. Trump brought several presidential records with him to Florida. After several requests, he surrendered 15 boxes of documents to the archives in January. Some of the documents were marked classified, so the agency contacted the Justice Department about them. In the U.S., law enforcement searches require permission from a judge. Though a search warrant does not suggest that criminal charges are near or even expected, investigators must persuade a judge that they have probable cause that a crime happened. Trump noted in his long statement that nothing like this has ever happened to a president of the United States before. Experts suggest that the warrant had to have been supported by FBI Director Christopher Wray, a Trump appointee, and Attorney General Merrick Garland, who was appointed by President Joe Biden. Philip Halpern is a former government lawyer who worked on public corruption cases. He told Reuters, "This is as big a deal as you can have, and every single person in the chain would have had to sign off on this." White House officials said President Joe Biden learned about the search through reporting from news organizations. Thomas Schwartz is a Vanderbilt University history professor who studies and writes about the presidency. He told the Associated Press that there is no precedent for a former president facing an FBI search, even going back to Watergate. At that time, Richard Nixon was not permitted to take tapes or other materials from the White House when he resigned as president in 1974, Schwartz noted. This is different, and it is a sign of how unique the Trump period was, said Schwartz. On Monday night, the former president accused Democrats of weaponization of the justice system to keep him from running for president in 2024. Several Republican governors and Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader in the House of Representatives, used the same term to attack the search at Trump's home. The search, however, is not the only legal issue that Trump is facing. The former president is currently facing legal issues concerning his businesses in New York and investigations into possible election wrongdoing and the January 6th attack on Congress. I'm Katie Weaver.
Near record amounts of algae, or water plants, are covering Caribbean coasts from Puerto Rico to Barbados. The plants are killing fish and other wildlife, producing bad smells and gases, and hurting tourism. The University of South Florida's Optical Oceanography Lab said nearly 22 million metric tons of brown algae, called sargassum, appeared in the Atlantic Ocean in June. That was 20% more than the record set in 2018. And unusually large amounts of sargassum have floated into the Caribbean Sea. The plants recently surrounded Pinel Island, near the French Caribbean territory of San Martin. The normally clear blue waters turned brown, forcing officials to stop boat service and cancel fun activities on the water. Oswin Corbell is the owner of Caribbean Paddling. He said he had to close his San Martin business on July 22nd, and does not expect to reopen until late October. He estimated he has lost at least $10,000. Maybe I should give up. Sometimes I think I should go into the mountains and herd sheep, but this is what I know to do, he said. The United Nations Caribbean Environment Program said some reasons for the overgrowth include a rise in water temperatures, chemical fertilizer, and wastewater that feed the brown plants. Lisa Krimsky is with Florida Sea Grant, a program working to protect the coast. She said as algae break down, they change water temperatures and the acidity of the water. In turn, that hurts other living things, such as seagrass and corals. The algae have hurt humans too. The government of the French island of Guadeloupe issued a health alert in late July. It warned some communities about high levels of hydrogen sulfide gas escaping from the rotting algae. The gas, which smells like rotten eggs, can affect people with breathing problems. Last month, the U.S. Virgin Islands warned of unusually high amounts of sargassum getting into the machinery at a desalination plant near St. Croix. The plant is struggling to produce fresh water from seawater, leading the U.S. government to declare an emergency due to water shortage. Small amounts of sargassum help clean water and take in carbon dioxide. It is an important part of the natural environment for fish, turtles, shrimp, crabs, and other creatures. It is also used in fertilizer, food, biofuel, building materials, and medicinal products. But it is bad for tourism and the environment when too much builds up near the coast or on beaches. On Union Island, which is part of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, the algae invasion has recently forced some tourist areas to close for up to 5 months. Large masses of sargassum also have hurt the Caribbean's fishing industry. They damage boat engines and fishing equipment and prevent fishermen from reaching their vessels and fishing grounds. Fewer fish are caught. Barbados, where the beaches are covered with reddish-brown algae, has been hit especially hard. Too much sargassum was thought to cause the recent deaths of thousands of fish in the French Caribbean island of Martinique. Activists are now worried about how it affects endangered turtles. Some are dying at sea while struggling to move through the algae. Some are unable to lay their eggs over the algae-covered sand. Some island nations use heavy machinery to remove algae from the beach, but scientists warn that it causes erosion and may also destroy the nests of endangered turtles. I'm Ana Mateo.
Across the United States, pandemic aid money is helping to fund a growing number of big city schools with shrinking numbers of students. When the money runs out in a few years, officials will face a difficult choice: keep the schools open despite the financial difficulty, or close them, upsetting communities looking for stability for their children. The summer program at Chalmers School of Excellence in Chicago, Illinois, offers one-on-one teaching that parents love. But school principal Romeo Crockett worries the school is becoming too small. Chalmers lost almost one-third of its enrollment during the pandemic. Today, only 215 students attend Chalmers. In Chicago, COVID-19 worsened enrollment declines that began before the virus. Some poor black neighborhoods in the city, like Chalmers' North Lawndale, have seen families leave in large numbers over the past 10 years. The number of small schools like Chalmers is growing in many American cities. More than 1 in 5 New York City elementary schools had fewer than 300 students last school year. In Los Angeles, California, over 1 in 4 have fewer than 300 students. In Chicago, nearly 1 in 3 are that small. In Boston, Massachusetts, it is almost 1 in 2. These numbers come from research by Chalkbeat and the Associated Press. Many of these schools were not designed to be small. Educators worry there will be smaller budgets in the coming years, even as schools continue to recover from the pandemic. "When you lose kids, you lose resources," Crockett said. "That impacts your ability to serve kids with very high needs." A state law prevents Chicago from closing or combining its schools until 2025. Across the U.S., COVID-19 relief money is helping fund shrinking schools. It is unclear what will happen to those schools when the funding runs out. My worry is that we will shut down when we have all worked so hard, said Yvonne Wooden, who serves on Chalmers School Council. That would really hurt our neighborhood. The pandemic quickened enrollment declines in many districts. Many families started homeschooling or sought enrollment at charter schools and private schools. Some students moved away or stopped attending school for unknown reasons. Many districts like Chicago give schools money for each individual student. That means small schools sometimes struggle to pay for costs like the principal, a counselor, or building upkeep. To deal with that, many school systems send extra money to small schools, taking money from larger schools. In Chicago, the district spends an average of $19,000 yearly per student at small high schools. Students at larger high schools get $10,000, Chalkbeat and the AP found. Small schools are popular with families, teachers, and community members because of their supportive environment. Some argue that districts should send more money into these schools. Many such schools are in Black and Latino neighborhoods that have been hit hard by the pandemic. In 2013, 50 schools closed in Chicago. Most were in Black neighborhoods. The move damaged trust between locals and the district. It also hurt learning for students from poor families, researchers at the University of Chicago found. When schools close, it is devastating for families, said Sileka Soto. She is with the Boston Education Justice Alliance, which supports underrepresented students. And then if parents don't like it, then they'll remove their children from the public school system, she said. Still, some city school systems losing students are considering school closures. Earlier this year, the school board in Oakland, California, voted to close several small schools despite protests. In other cities, leaders have continued to invest in small schools. Chicago received $2.8 billion in COVID-19 relief. It will use about $140 million of the money to help small schools this school year, officials said. In Los Angeles and New York City, officials say they are centering their efforts on bringing students back into school, not closing them. But federal relief money will run out in 2 years. Districts must use the money by September 2024. When the money is no longer there, it may be difficult for districts to keep small schools open. It's a huge problem, said Bruce Fuller, an education researcher at the University of California, Berkeley. It's going to be increasingly difficult for superintendents to justify keeping these places open as the number of these schools continues to rise. I'm Dan Novak.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about William McKinley. He took office in 1897 and was re-elected in 1900. He led the United States into the 20th century. One way to think of McKinley is as a transition president. In the 1800s, lawmakers were mostly concerned with how the country was growing in North America. But during McKinley's government, the U.S. looked beyond its borders. Congress declared war on Spain, the first time the U.S. had fought a European power since the War of 1812 against Britain. The U.S. also took control of overseas territories, annexed Hawaii, and tried to regulate the world's trade with China. Some historians say President McKinley himself wanted the U.S. to increase its international influence. Others argue that he was just answering the country's mood at the time. Either way, his presidency is often defined by the country's rise as an imperial power. McKinley was the sixth president to come from the state of Ohio. He was the seventh of eight children. Historians describe his childhood as loving and fun. His father owned a small iron factory. His mother raised her children to be honest and polite. McKinley was a hard-working student. He briefly attended Allegheny College in Pennsylvania, but he did not have the money to finish his education there. A few years after leaving that school, he volunteered for the Army on the side of the Union in the Civil War. He served under a man who would later become president himself, Rutherford B. Hayes. The two stayed close throughout their lives. After the war ended, McKinley studied law, became involved in Republican Party politics, married, and had two daughters. His wife, Ida, was an energetic, well-educated young woman from a wealthy family. For a while, she had worked in her father's bank. But Ida McKinley's health began to suffer. She was struck by seizures. Then her mother died. A few months later, her younger daughter died while still an infant. Ida McKinley clung to her older daughter, but the little girl soon developed a fever disease, and she died too. William and Ida McKinley were never the same. Ida McKinley remained sick her entire life. She spent most of her hours in a small rocking chair sewing. William McKinley paid great attention to her. He organized his schedule to spend time near her, even as his political success grew. In time, McKinley served in Congress and as the governor of Ohio. He was known as a likable person and a skilled politician. His Republican Party nominated him on the first ballot at their convention. A few months later, voters elected McKinley into office in a landslide. He became the country's 25th president. When McKinley took office, the U.S. was just coming out of a severe economic depression. His government quickly approved a high protective tariff to help struggling workers. In general, his administration also permitted the growth of big business. But most of McKinley's attention as president was devoted to foreign policy. The main issue was Cuba. At that time, Spain controlled the island. Cubans revolted, and Spanish forces used violence and detainments to crush the rebellion. In the U.S., many Americans denounced the events in Cuba. They wanted McKinley and his government to intervene. At first, President McKinley was unwilling. He tried to use diplomacy. He even ordered a U.S. ship into Spanish waters near Havana to show his continued support of Spain. But the ship, called the Maine, exploded. Americans believed the Spanish were responsible. Relations between the two countries worsened fast. Spain declared war. The U.S. Congress answered in kind. For 100 days, U.S. and Spanish forces fought in Cuba and other areas under Spanish control. The war quickly turned in the Americans' favor. When the Spanish-American War ended with the Treaty of Paris in 1898, the U.S. took control of Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines from Spain. Cuba was made independent. However, the U.S. continued to occupy the island for several more years. Not everyone approved of the actions of McKinley's government. Even some members of Congress warned against the U.S. becoming an imperial power. But a majority of voters approved of McKinley as a victorious commander-in-chief. They also noted that the U.S. economy was getting stronger. In 1900, McKinley won re-election. As it turned out, McKinley's second term in office was short. In September, only 6 months after his swearing in, the president was receiving visitors at a fair in the city of Buffalo, New York. One of the visitors in line was a 28-year-old man named Leon Czolgosz. His family was from Poland, but he lived in the city of Detroit, Michigan. He had worked in a factory, but at the time was unemployed. He supported the idea of anarchy, no government at all. When McKinley reached to shake the young man's hand, Czolgosz shot the president twice in the stomach. Although injured, McKinley spoke to his guards. He told them not to hurt the shooter, and he expressed concern about how his wife would feel when she learned he had been shot. Quickly, McKinley was taken to a hospital. Doctors predicted that he would survive. And for a few days, McKinley seemed to improve. But the wound became infected, and 8 days after the attack, McKinley died. The president's murderer did not say he was sorry for his act. He defended it, saying McKinley was an enemy of working people. Within a few weeks of the shooting, Czolgosz was tried, found guilty, and executed. Both the nation and the world mourned when McKinley died. He had been one of the country's most popular presidents in many years. He left behind the beginning of what some called an American empire. He also marked a change in the U.S. presidency. When he first took office in the 19th century, most presidents acted primarily as administrators. But President McKinley began to act in ways that are more like a modern president. He prepared remarks to give to the media. He traveled across the country speaking to voters. He used the power of his office to direct the armed forces. McKinley laid the groundwork, but he did not completely change the presidency. He left that to the even more famous man who followed him into the White House. After McKinley's death, his vice president, Theodore Roosevelt, took office and truly brought the country into modern times. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
That's our program for today.
Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm...